Nick, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Good to talk to you as always.
Nick, it's impossible to get into the recapping, without the unfortunate way it ended. It's not the worst part. I mean, the worst part is how difficult it is for Inhibish Ganbat and the Mongolian stable people, losing this horse. That's the worst part, but it just diminishes everything that preceded it.
Well, it certainly overshadows the event in terms of how it's been covered in the subsequent days. But I don't think we should seek to diminish everything that preceded it, because an awful lot that preceded it was horse racing at its very best. And I think you make the salient point, Steve, that too little was said about how the people closest to the horse might be feeling, and possibly too much was said about the impact it was going to have on the sport or what the sport should do. I felt that there was a sort of platitude overload, really, and not really enough concern toward the people for whom this was the biggest blow, and that was the people closest to the horse, and the people who put so much love, care, and attention into campaigning the horse boldly, ambitiously, and ultimately to the Breeders' Cup Classic that didn't end the way any of us wanted it to. But the people who would have been most upset on Saturday night were not the track organisers or the people who wanted the race to go off without incident, or you or me or anybody else, for all that we felt. It was a great disappointment and understood the wider significance of it. The people who would have been most upset and feeling it most keenly were those closest to the horse.
Yeah, and the presence of the Mongolian team, thinking back to the excitement and the color and the pageantry of the turf sprint win at Keeneland and what that, Mongolian Saturday and they were celebrated, so much that, it just felt so bad. And knowing what we've seen reported and discussing things with Jay Privman, who's been in contact with Ganbat, and he's devastated. He not only does he lose the horse for with his owner, but he feels like he's let down the industry, and that part is a burden that no one should have to endure.
And he shouldn't feel that way unless there's any concrete evidence that that's the case. And I know that there's been a lot of recrimination in the days since, and it would be unwise, I think, to comment too much on that. People analysing the video footage of the horse training and so on and so forth. But I think it's unwise to draw any hard and fast conclusions on that until a bit more evidence comes to light, Steve, really. And I think
I agree.
Sometimes the industry is best just to... obviously, we know that the lessons of the last couple of years have told us anything. It's that we don't ignore things. We're transparent, and we try to uncover reasons for tragic accidents or fatalities. But I do think it's sensible sometimes just to keep your counsel until you know exactly the full extent of the facts. And I think there's been an awful lot of comment without hard, cold, hard factual evidence.
I would agree. Let's talk about the moments that were uplifting and were particularly special. These wins for the individuals involved, from the breeder and everybody that handled the horse, through to the current connections, is always going to be special. From your perspective, I imagine Joseph O'Brien's win. And you spent a considerable amount of time with Joseph and Aiden pre-race, and I thought that was one of the really sweet moments, and the genuine joy that people were demonstrating for Joseph, and the win by Iridesa. That is one of the things that's staying with me from the weekend.
I think that's right. You've got that counterpoint between the huge power of the two stables, the huge numerical financial heft of the two stables of Aidan and Joseph, and then that real human, genuine delight for the young man winning and really continuing to make his name on the international stage. It's nothing short of phenomenal what he's achieved. Yes, he's had the best possible start in life, and his parents have quite simply forces of nature, Aidan and Anne-Marie, with what they've achieved in their careers. But what he has set up there with very much his own inside vision, team, is extraordinary. Succeeding under both codes as well, succeeding on all continents, it's new group of owners. It's amazing. And it's clearly an incredibly popular figure. And for all he's achieved and for all he's been at every Breeders' Cup since he can remember, the moment wasn't lost on him at all. He wasn't remotely blasé about it. He's quite content to let his feelings show, and I thought that was nice to see. And she was a legitimate winner as well. She came into the race a three-time Grade 1 winner and a Grade 1 winner as a two-year-old as well. So it was sort of nice to see the cream coming to the fore, really. Quite often when you might only get one European winner or two, and quite a few of them haven't really cut much ice, there's a bit of a grumble and mumble from these parts, as though it's somehow the event's fault, and then everyone vents their spleen at the Breeders' Cup. Well, this isn't a proper World Championships, and look at this racing, it's all on dirt and round a tight left-handed bend, and the grass tracks are too tight and too firm, and look at this, all the horses are on drugs, and the bald fact of it is that if you take a B or C team to a World Championship event, then you're going to get your pants taken down. Don't complain about it. You've got to take your best horses if you want to win. And it's so frustrating. Obviously, you do get the odd horse that makes a significant transitional improvement from going from Europe to the US and thrives, and you know might want a bit of help from Lasix or whatever. Yes, there are horses that improve, but by and large, if you look at Breeders' Cup since 1984 till now, the European horses that win are the ones that are better than all the others. And I don't think it's much of an exception. Iridesa was a legitimate winner. You know, he took Sister Charlie out of the race. She was perfectly legitimate.
And you know, for Wayne Lorden, he turned in a terrific performance, and the timing and you know when he went and confronted Vasilika, who absolutely was not overwhelmed at all. I mean, she stayed on with Flavie and Pratt, and meanwhile behind the exacta pair, Sister Charlie was able to hold off Fanny Logan, who I really was taken with during the week, and I thought ran a really good race from a difficult post and is going to be a filly to watch going forward, depending on whatever Gosden's plans are for her next year.
Well, you think Fanny Logan ought to just work backwards from the same race next year.
I agree.
Because you sort of sense they almost went into the race not half-cocked, but it was a bit of a sighter. You know, you didn't feel that there was massive confidence from the camp that she was really capable of winning. I sort of kept saying to Frankie, I don't think it's impossible. And he was sort of, well, yeah, but he knew Gosden's got five or six better fillies at home, but Fanny Logan was the one on the upgrade. So I'd sort of be with you, really. They want to work backwards from that race next year. I think quick ground's important to her. They wouldn't want a wet week at Keeneland, but if she gets that far and they don't retire her, she's going to be a player in all those top races next year, I think, as you say. But for that draw, she might have been, well, at least second. But it was a race that panned out nicely for Iridesa, because if there's one thing that's crucial to her, it's a strong pace at whatever distance she runs. And I think Murph going a second quicker for the half mile than she had done in the preceding race, was in the Rodeo Drive, I think that helped Iridesa massively.
We're going to talk about some horses that were disappointments. Bill Zidane Brook and Villa Marina and Castle Lady, who really folded up the tent, But Bill Zidane Brook in particular was a horse that a lot of people had latched onto by Saturday. And I mean, no visible excuse. I mean, neither she nor Villa Marina ever mounted a much of a charge.
Yeah, I think the ground was probably a bit quick for the French Felice Castle Lady of Villa Marina. And as for Bill Zidane Brook, I hoped she'd run a bit better, particularly if she'd come back to form so well in her previous race at Newmarket. I really did hope that was a sort of signal of better things to come. But I just think she's big filly, and maybe the track really wasn't up her street. She just never really seemed to get a hold of it at all.
You know who ran well with and has gotten no credit really is Just Wonderful at 50-1.
Yeah, she did. I stuck her up as a long shot on the Breeders' Cup show on NBC on Thursday, and I thought she might just sneak into third, but she did run very well, and she was sort of ridden to pick up the pieces, and unfortunately she just couldn't pick up quite enough pieces.
Talk a little bit about a couple. Let's hit the the obvious topics with the Euro involvement, and it's funny that well in advance of the mile, Nick, the filly and the mare got Stormy and Uni. They were the talking points. And then we got here, and people started panning for gold elsewhere. And then in the stretch, it was the filly and the mare.
Yeah, it was like, why did we ignore the obvious, wasn't it? Really?
Exactly.
They were just a cut above all the others. I mean, Circus Maximus did the best of the Europeans, and that was about a fair reflection of where they should all have finished. I thought, hey, Gammon ran quite a nice race from a wide draw. Frankie got him over, didn't go too quick. If it had been seven-eighths race, then I think he'd have been interesting. But the rest of them just weren't good enough. Simple as that. They weren't good enough. I thought Swedwa was legitimate to pick up some pieces, but he was scratched on the morning of the race, unfortunately. And as I say, the rest either weren't suited or weren't good enough. Mainly the latter. Circus Maximus, I honestly didn't really fancy him. He ran better than I expected him to. But that's as good as he is. And the two fillies are just a bit better.
We should mention, and I exchanged notes with John Gunther last night. Without parole, Chad Brown obviously breathing life into his career after really a dismal season.
Yeah, and it makes sense, doesn't it? It makes sense where he finished on his best mile form as a 3-year-old when he looked so good at Sandown and then went and won St. James's Palace. That made sense where he finished. He's back to that sort of form. That makes him a slightly better horse than Circus Maximus. That makes sense from a European perspective. And it makes sense to me as well that the pair of them conceding weight to the fillies could be outspeeded by fillies and mare, or a filly and a mare with a superior turn of foot at the distance.
Talk about the turf where bricks and mortar, it looked at one point at the top of the stretch, turning for home, it looked like he was a little mired, and he's produced by Rad Ortiz. And poor Richard Mandela, who, if somebody had said, you're going to finish second with your two starters on Saturday, you wouldn't have expected United to be... to do what he did, but he ran a courageous race. And I saw Mandela come on the track, and he was wide-eyed about, he thought he was going to win it mid-stretch, but bricks and mortar finishes the year unbeaten.
Well, United's the horse to take seriously now for next year, isn't he? That's for sure. He wasn't given much love because he's a California-based turf horse, and he'd been beaten in his previous start, but there were excuses for that, and he turned that form around comprehensively. I must say, I thought he might run quite well. I didn't expect him to run that well. That did come as a surprise. Nor did I expect Old Persian to run as badly as he did. He just blew out completely. And I don't subscribe to the view that Anthony Van Dyke would have won with a clear path. I know that's been debated quite a bit. Don't buy that at all. If you look down the back, Ryan Moore was at various points in the race trying to put him into various holes that he didn't have the tactical speed to get into. He's just not a very fast horse, and I'm afraid that was his undoing. And yes, he may have finished a bit closer with a clear run, but I don't think he would have won. In fact, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have won. So, bricks and mortar was a thoroughly worthy winner who overcame adverse circumstances in terms of the distance that was too far and a steady early pace where he was a bit rank, and he overcame that and still was good enough to beat them. It wasn't a vintage group, but he got the job done. Should we debate Horse of the Year now, Steve? Is this the right time to do that?
It is because, of course, the races that preceded this were vitally important, given Mattioli, who comes through and ran a brilliant sprint. Then came Midnight Bisou being mildly upset. I don't think it was a monumental shock, but when Bricks and Mortar wins and finishes the season unbeaten, and considering the races that he ran, it felt like, okay, he's your horse of the year.
So it's the classic argument, really, isn't it? But just wrapped up in different paper. So often the argument about horse of the year is, say, Kentucky Derby winner against worthy older horse who's won a stack of Grade One, or Triple Crown winner, dare I say it, when there was argument about whether Justify should or shouldn't be the Horse of the Year against worthy older horses won a load of Group Ones. Isn't this the same argument wrapped up in a different way? Isn't Bricks and Mortar a horse with a terrific backstory as far as he's come back off surgery and strung seven consecutive victories together, including five Grade Ones? But that is cast against the unarguably more substantial form in terms of pure merit of what has been achieved from a form perspective of say a Mattioli. And it's a question of whether you jump one way or the other, whether you award Horse of the Year to a horse with a glittering CV or the slightly more glittering CV in terms of races won, amount of Grade Ones won, good backstory, versus a horse who on sort of by any recognized contextual horse racing metric has probably run greater races or has shown greater athletic prowess. And sort of in my view, I sort of just edge toward the latter, I think.
Interesting. I understand that, and I'm usually somebody that would gravitate toward a classic American kind of a campaign, or the important kind of events like a Met Mile and so forth, and here's Mattioli having won at 6-7 and a mile, and the one turn mile, and that's notable. I think one part of this with Bricks and Mortar that came up this week, I forget who brought it up, the fact that he actually finished off the season doing something that he hadn't been anticipating until literally weeks before. And
I think everything about the horse is hugely, hugely admirable, isn't it? It's the massive layoff. It's the fact that he's been on the go from January through November. He's not been campaigned even as sparingly as they thought he might be in the middle of the year. And he's won at the top level at multiple distances. And against the best that Europe could throw at him, but, what Europe consented to throw at him anyway, in the Breeders' Cup. So that's not his fault. That's not his fault. He's a smashing racehorse. He really is. I think it's reasonable to expect that quite a few voters in this year's awards will have their pen hovering over the box for more than a second or two. Maybe everyone will just take Bricks and Mortar and be done with it.
I think there's going to be plenty of votes in Mattioli's direction, and I think it's going to be Bricks and Mortar. It'll be like a 60-30-10 Bricks and Mortar Mattioli Midnight Bisou.
You feel a bit sorry for Midnight Bisou, don't you? Because you could certainly argue that she didn't get the rub of the green. And she has been aggressively campaigned in a fantastic fashion, really. And yeah, you sort of feel that she's worthy of more than 60, than a 60-30-10 split. But that's that's life, I'm afraid.
Yeah. It's she needed to win out, honestly, that, with all the nice things that have happened for her, and that there's a parade of trophies that for her to treasure, I was very pleased for Nacho Correas and Joe Bravo for them to have that moment, and particularly for Correas, who is
without doubt. And if there's one person who was happier than Nacho Correas, it was the reporter from San Isidro Argentinian Radio. Did you see him?
Yes.
I swear, I have never seen a press man. Excited doesn't even begin to describe it. The guy was on another planet.
Yes.
After the race, it was great to watch. But it showed you how much it meant to the racing fraternity in Argentina. I mean, this was a massively significant moment. What a tremendous mare she's been.
Well, I embarrassed him the other day when I called him the heir to the North American tradition of Luro and Penna. I mean, he is the next generation, and Kevin Plank can eat his kishkas out for not that Stanley Huff is, you know, Stan's doing a wonderful job, but you know, jettisoning Nacho Correas the way he did was just preposterous.
Well, he's got a Breeders' Cup victory to his name now, and a very important one at that. And everyone was saying, "Oh, she's been training lights out, been going so well." And every time you try to fashion a case for her, the smart guys would turn around and say, "Oh, she can only run at Keeneland. She's only good at Keeneland." Well, I'm really glad she showed she could do it outside of Kentucky as well, and do it in style.
Before we talk about Friday and the fact that I don't think anybody's ever coming again for the Juvenile Turf Sprint from Europe. You said that, not me. You said that. I'm paraphrasing you. Your thoughts about Vino Rosso, who, you know, really, I called it Todd Pletcher's best training job, you know, certainly with an older horse. This was a masterful execution, what he pulled off.
Well, he worked out that the Breeders' Cup Classic was going to be run this year at Santa Anita, so he made sure he brought the horse to a Grade One at Santa Anita earlier in the year and showed his liking for the track, and then conditioned him beautifully up to the race, for sure. What a triumph again, but you were talking about John Gunther. What a triumph for them. I mean, Triple Crown winner last year, and a Breeders' Cup Classic winner this year, and a Royal Ascot winner last year, and they owned and bred a Breeders' Cup Mile Third as well for a, you know, mid-sized breeding operation. That is pretty phenomenal, and I don't know how they top it now. Just do the same all over again, I suppose. But brilliant training performance from Todd Pletcher, and not fitting, really, given everything else he's achieved. This was the sort of one, as he said, it was the one gap on his CV, which he's now, or his resume, that he's now filled. So, well done to him. Obviously, the ownership was ecstatic afterwards, and it celebrated the way we like our Breeders' Cup champions to celebrate, and made sure there was a good mention of the Jockey Club Gold Cup in there for good measure. So, yeah, all of the above. Shame we're not going to see the horse next year, really, because that was, we're just starting to see the best of him. And you know, through a three-year-old year, you always thought, well, he's going to be better next year, and you watched that and you thought, well, he could probably be better with another winter under his belt. But it seems that that's a bit of a motif of the last couple of weeks, lots of horses retiring a bit more prematurely than might be the case.
Well, plenty of two-year-olds that will spend the winter growing and changing. And when it came to the start of the whole event, looking at that turf sprint, the juvenile, there were plenty of cases to be made. Simon Crisford's Ali, who, you know, had a lot of support. The gates opened, and it was completely all Wesley Ward and just that raw speed, essentially.
Yeah, even his other filly, Canary, couldn't really get into it. But four-wheel drive ran a wonderful race from the front. It was exciting to watch. You said nobody will ever come again. That was my initial reaction. I thought, oh, here we go. Here's another race that's been designed to attract European horses and bring more European trainers to the event. And it's going to have exactly the adverse effect if it carries on like this. That was my initial reaction. But thinking about it again, there are a couple of things that struck me. First of all, 2 years ago at Del Mar, they ran the race on the undercard, and it was won by a horse coming from off the pace trained by Aidan O'Brien, Declaration of Peace.
Right.
So that gave me some hope. Now, obviously, to counter that, that was on the undercard, so you're not going to get it targeted by a Wesley, and it's not going to attract maybe the very best local horses. So maybe that's a bit of a false indication. But the other thing I'd say is that there was one European horse that got out of the gate, Dr. Simpson, who ran a fine race, ended up leading to finish fifth, but I thought was probably the second or third best horse in the race, and paid for really trying to chase down a very, very smart, fast horse in four-wheel drive. Now, Dr. Simpson is not the best sprinting juvenile in Europe, far from it. So if that horse can run as well as that horse managed to do, then I don't think it's completely outlandish to suggest that a European-trained horse can win the race. They've just got to be, A, fast enough, and B, good enough. Arlie was the one that had the form credentials. He was parked wide on the track. And the rest of them either weren't good enough or weren't quick enough.
They'll go back to the drawing board. Meanwhile, for the girls and the boys' races, going the mile, Nick, interesting that it turned out this year that the boys' race ends up being very domestic, and it's been the boys where the Euros have fared well, and it was in the girls' race where Albinia and Daye ran essentially races that could win that event.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly the males' race, there were only two European runners in it, so and one of them was not credentialed, and the other one, who was extremely credentialed, had a bad post and an indifferent trip, and was probably bouncing off a huge effort, and in terms of physique, might not have been exactly the right horse to be running in that race. So all your eggs are in the one basket. So it didn't massively surprise me. I interviewed Michael Tabor just beforehand, and I didn't exactly detect a whole lot of confidence from him. And then the fillies race was a bit more representative, really, because Albinia and Daya are two of the better fillies of their division in Europe, and they ran accordingly. And I thought Daya ran a really, really solid race. That's exactly what she is. That's right up to scratch. She's just a hint below the very, very best. But she's a really good, solid, versatile filly who stays well. Albinia's better than her, but just didn't really get the rub of the green. And the race had unfolded by the time she got going, and she was out finishing absolutely hand over fist. So I think their performances were reflective of their ability level, and I think at least we came to the fight armed with the right weapons.
Agreed, and happy. I mean, personally, sharing was my play of the day, and from that standpoint, pleased for the connections, and it's a great story too, being out of Breeders' Cup winners, and. You know, that part I thought played well, and then
wasn't
Nick,
wasn't it Sire Dam, wasn't it all Breeders' Cup winners? Amazing.
Yep, Pleasantly Perfect in there as well. Yeah, it was great, and Manny Franco gets his first win, and of course you can't run a Santa Anita Breeders' Cup without Brittany Erton crying and carrying on when her father wins a race.
Well, there's no doubt that the juvenile Colts race on Friday made our telecast, and it was great to see. It was great to see, because I don't think that Brittany had necessarily any preordained intention to interview Pete after the race. But we all agreed between us, unbeknownst to her, that if the unlikely, and it was unlikely going into the race, if the unlikely happened, then we'd all stand aside and make her do it. But it's a tribute to her great professionalism and skill that she was able to compose herself, having gone completely loopy, even by her own high standards, during the race, to then go and interview Peter. And for the first 7/8 of the interview, if you were just turning it on, you'd never even know that she'd ever met the guy. And anyone who knows them knows how, you know, even by normal father and daughter standards, knows how close they are. So it was great. Yeah, as I say, amazing tribute to her professionalism. And then you got the kind of a little emotion seeping through at the end. So it was lovely to watch. I was really thrilled for them. And Peter's such a hardworking guy and is a very capable trainer. And he'd quietly been telling people that this was a good horse, but wasn't sort of shouting about it. And the way things panned out meant that the race was ripe for a shock. And very happy that it was those guys that pulled it off. Be interesting to see what the targets are for that horse next year. I know, just chatting to Brittany, I was saying, well, the Thistles will run as long as you want. She went, well, he's by Court Vision. I said, well, the Court Vision was the turf miler who sprung the big surprise over Golda Cova, wasn't he, in 2011. Yeah, who knows what he's going to sire, to be honest. He might be capable of anything. And there's every possibility that he could just keep running as far as he wanted him to.
Now, it throws a bit of a wacky storyline into the 2-year-old and the lead up toward Derby season and the Derby trail, yeah, and all that. But that's all right. This is not the first time that's happened. And you know, Wilco, thinking back to Wilco's win, in fact. You know, there's been others.
Oh yeah, so there've been a few shocks in the race for sure. Yeah. No doubt about that. But if you've got a horse that's won the race, you live the dream for a bit, don't you? If you've got a horse that you think's pretty honest and stays, then you've got to live the dream at least until the first Saturday in May. I mean, I suppose at this point, he's at least a legitimate entrant in the race, and it's very interesting. I thought that it didn't take Chad Brown long to tell me after the race that his juvenile turf winner structure was a very likely to head onto the Triple Crown trail, and that'd be his last race on turf for a while, and that he preordained that with the owners even before he started out on this route. So that he's obviously going to be interesting, and we hopefully will see Maxfield back before too long. He certainly is a 2-year-old that made the biggest impression on me. Dennis's moment, you can presumably forgive what happened to him. I don't know whether you can be quite so forgiving about 8 Rings, who's obviously quirky anyway.
But it felt like the clock had already struck midnight for him. Well before Friday, there was a negative vibe. You know, and I suppose one of the conversations I had yesterday with Paul Matisse, and we talked about how the accessibility of the video for not just workouts but even gallops are now, you know, readily accessible coming into these events, and that 8 Rings just did not look up to snuff for this assignment, and it really played out.
Yeah, I mean, you just wonder whether, you know, that mental immaturity or quirk or whatever it is about him had just caught up with him a little bit. But I'm sure Bob Baffert's got other horses that he's looking forward to getting cracking with next year, or even to the back end of this year.
Well, 1,000 words, certainly. Looking forward to his next outing. And speaking of next outings, Nick, your agenda going forward here until your next sojourn to these shores.
Well, I'm at home for a while now, which I'm sure will be to the great relief of all At the Races regulars. No, I'm here. I'm doing a fair bit of jump racing now between now and the new year. It's the Cartier Awards next week, so that'll be interesting and enjoyable, I'm sure. It always is. Then my next international assignment is I'm going to Bahrain. They're beefing up their international race day, and that is in 2 weeks' time. So I'm off there for the first time. And, of course, Interesting news the other day that Midnight Bees may go to the Saudi Cup, 29th of February 2020, which I'm sure got an interesting reception back home, Steve.
Yeah, got an interesting reception from me at the top of the hour, the top of the show.
I'm afraid I wasn't tuned in at the top of the show, so you can run it by me.
I find the concept offensive, and I don't understand people running to. Our own government, the constant placating of the Saudis. The whole thing to me is, I'm aghast by the whole thing.
Well, there you have it.
I'm sorry.
Is it the part of the world itself, or is it more the idea of pop-up races worth a lot of money? Would you have the same view if they said, right, we want to go for the Pegasus and out, for example, or Dubai? Where would the Dubai World Cup fit? I'm not sort of casting doubt one way or the other.
It's the regime and the. The policies and practices that that we as a nation are supposed to be protesting the principles of what our country used to at least represent, and I find going there to legitimize and to aggrandize them. I find off-putting.
It'll be interesting to see the entry that it gets in the first incarnation and how it sort of sits into the international horse racing firmament, for sure. I have to declare an interest. I have had some involvement already in this project. And I can see why people may have some reservations, but I think it will be a more significant horse racing event, at least in its first incarnation, than people might necessarily think.
And on that topic, this is a very thorny issue, and especially for interests here, because it certainly feels like that our industry doesn't want to necessarily address these kinds of topics. In this particular case, going there to me is the part that just doesn't play. I thought about when this thing was announced. I was laid up, but I immediately had the concerns that this is not something that we should be participating in and giving participating in from that standpoint, and then I tried to balance it, Nick, with thinking about Judmont, and I think there's a big difference between appreciating Prince Khalid and Judmont's operation and then going to Saudi Arabia to participate in this event. Maybe I'm parsing this conveniently, but I just think it's something people should at least address internally.
I think naturally people will have reservations about all of the above, and I can understand that. From my perspective, when I was asked to get involved in the project, I too had similar reservations, and I said I was very keen to meet the people that were involved with the project before embarking on the project. Now, I've met Prince Bandar, who's the chairman of the Racing Club of Saudi Arabia, several times now, and you can only speak as you find. And he has what I would consider to be an extremely modern outlook on horse racing and indeed on life, and his grasp on the global political scene is such that you don't feel at odds with his world view. And that, as much as anything else, persuaded me that this was certainly worth exploring and worth seeing before I was going to be passing significant judgments on its kind of ethical its own internal ethics, and B,
right,
its effectiveness as an international horse racing event. And I believe his personal motivation for putting on this event is an honourable one, and is a desire to see what has habitually been somewhere that has bred and raced thoroughbreds, and do so on a class one stage rather than a class three stage. It's not as though, this is different from boxing events, Formula One events, and so forth that have been put on in the same country, because they are being put on apropos of no great history of such events in that country, whereas horse racing has taken place, forever in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and in that part of the world. It's in, essentially, it's indigenous to that part of the world, and it's currently a Category 3 horse racing country, and it wants to be a Category 1 horse racing country. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with that aspiration.
No.
That's the view that I've cautiously taken on it for the time being.
No, and this fits into the same or similar discussions regarding Olympics, and these kinds of things have been debated before, and it's just a personal level, and it's a tricky discussion, and I'm not wishing ill will. It struck me in light of recent events, particularly when you think that a certain area is making progress and extending liberties and equality for their citizenry, it seemed that Saudi Arabia was moving in that direction,
my own feeling is, and I'm cautious here. I realize there will be plenty of people who are quite cynical, and it's not as though I came down in the last shower. But my view is that the people who are organizing this particular event and the people who have aspirations to make this particular event something of a world leader, and the people who have aspirations to make this event something of significance in the context of global horse racing, are doing so with the right level of social responsibility, insofar as that they've made it clear that they want not only to welcome a mixed crowd, both in terms of gender and race, but also for that to be reflected amongst the people involved with the horses, be they trainers, jockeys, owners, etc. Particularly, he was particularly keen, Prince Pandar, to stress how much he welcomed the idea of female riders taking part, for example, which, given the history of recent history mm-hmm. of the country, is a pretty significant thing for a prince of that country to say.
Well, we'll see. See how this evolves. And maybe the origins of the World Cup, the Dubai World Cup had similar. Maybe there were similar issues raised back then. I don't even recall. It's been so long at this point, but Well, I we'll see how, you know, who participates, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to bypass that kind of a, you know, that kind of a purse. I mean, it I understand the motivations of Jeff Blum, you know, pointing Midnight Bizou, you know, there. I haven't heard any other, you know, any other names yet. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
The secondary point is an interesting one, isn't it? To the extent to which new events will ever be fully embraced, i.e., you know, when new events come along and they are big money events, notwithstanding any political concerns or geopolitical concerns, there is going to be a degree of skepticism because no one really knows what the event's going to be like, what the track's going to be like, how it's going to be run. Is there an infrastructure there to support it? You can't make that judgment call until you've seen one and done one. And these things tend not to succeed unless they have the confidence of the participants after one iteration. Yeah, we've seen them. There's plenty of big worldwide races that have started that haven't continued. So they tend to kind of succeed or fail, dare I say, organically. But
agreed. Yeah, that's
notwithstanding how much money you stick on the table.
No, exactly. And I mean, you look at the Breeders' Cup. In fact, it was discussed quite extensively this past week in California about how when the first running took part, and everybody looked at each other and said, "This is a one off. This is too good to be true. It'll never work." And here it is, you know, 35 years later. So it's the World Cup too. I mean, and the World Cup's gone through, you know, some issues between the installation of the synthetic and return to dirt and so forth, from Nad El Sheba to Maidan. But we'll see where this goes.
And let's face it, you know, there are issues that come out of Dubai and the Emirates that people mm-hmm. may not always feel entirely comfortable with. But, you know, there's very few people who feel uncomfortable with the involvement of the Maktoum family in horse racing, because they recognize the massive contribution to horse racing that they've made. But these things are rarely sensibly seen in anything other than shades of gray, I think.
Well put. Nick, as always, all the coverage leading through Breeders' Cup, and we had such a fun time meeting Gina as well. That was wonderful. First visit with her last week, and you, and safe travels. Thanks for everything, and we'll talk soon.
And I've already told Jonathan Kinch and Steve that his co-host Peter Fornatal promised me that he was voting for you in the America's Best Racing fan poll for cast of the year.
Do you have I haven't even looked at this thing yet. Are you presenter? Are you involved in the presenting category?
Somebody's put my name on a list, but I wouldn't make an assumption that means I'll be involved somehow. not against that level of competition. It's extremely stiff, and I'm, again, as with any photograph that appears of me on any such site, I look thoroughly miserable. Well, everyone grinning maniacally. So yeah,
too funny. Nick, thank you.
No worries, Steve.
Nick Luck, everybody, who you of course have to be following on Twitter, and Luck on Sunday, of course. And Nick actually had a very funny tweet the other day. He went from Santa Anita to Exeter was his next the next racetrack assignment after Breeders' Cup. We're going to stay here because we got too much to do between now and noon. And James Scully standing by. We'll get Scully in here. We'll get Scully's Breeders' Cup recapping, and Scully had a couple of poppers, had a couple of winners, by the time the weekend rolled around. Nick,